Welcome. This is episode 525 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the series on the 2024 Step 2 CK Free 120. This is going to be part 7. Again, I'll strongly encourage you, if you have the chance, listen to all the parts in this series. So much learning to get from this. So we've done the first 50 questions. Let's go to question 51. A 13-year-old girl is brought to the office for evaluation of short stature. Since birth, she has been below the 3rd percentile for height and at the 3rd percentile for weight. She has never had a menstrual period. There is no family history of short stature, but her maternal uncle did not begin puberty until the age of 16 years. Her current height is consistent with that of a 9.5-year-old girl. Pulse is 82 per minute, and blood pressure is 110 over 70. Sexual maturity reading is stage 1 for breast development and stage 2 for pubic hair development. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in diagnosis? Option A says complete blood count and serum chemistry panel. Option B says measurement of urine-free cortisol concentration. Option C says x-rays of the left hand and wrist. Option D says x-rays of the long bones and spine. Option E says x-ray of the skull. So if we look at this, this girl is short. And when we're dealing with short stature, many times people worry about two major kinds, right? There's either the familial short stature where your parents are short, it's kind of in the genes, so you're short. And then there's constitutional growth delay, where typically the child will be short, but the parents are not short. Typically, when you see that discrepancy, it makes you think that, you know what, this child will probably catch up as puberty draws to a close. Now, typically for you to make that judgment call on constitutional growth delay versus familial short stature, you're usually going to compare the child's chronological age to the child's bone age. Their chronological age is their real age. Their bone age is determined by radiography. And typically that radiography is going to be done with the hand and the wrist. So you then compare that because you can age bones on radiography. So you can see how old those bones are. Typically a child that has constitutional growth delay, which I suspect this girl has, their bones will be younger than their age. So that tells you that, oh, those bones have some catching up to do. And they will catch up. So this person should grow in the future. So the answer here is going to be C. When you want to assess short stature, this is one of those things where you either know it or you don't know it. You got to get x-rays of the left hand and wrist. And option B is wrong, because that's what you're using to use to confirm. One of the ways you can confirm if a person has hypercortisolism. Option A doesn't make any sense. There's not much it's going to give you to help you determine why the person has a short stature. All right, question 52. A 20-year-old woman comes to the office because of a one-year history of a lump on her left ear that appeared 2 months after she had the ear pierced. Physical examination shows the findings in the photograph. Which of the following is the most appropriate initial treatment for this patient? So if we're looking at this image, this does look like a keloid. So let's look at the answers here. Option A says corticosteroid injection. Option B says cryotherapy. Option C says laser ablation. Option D says needle aspiration. Option E says wide excision. So this person has a keloid. And remember, keloids are pretty common actually, in African Americans. And one thing I would say is, if you know that you have a keloid susceptibility, this could be easily be tested as a preventive medicine concept. A person that has keloid sensitivity should generally try to not have their skins pierced or heavily manipulated, because those things can lead them to forming a keloid. So this question is clearly asking about the management of a keloid. So how do we manage keloids? Well, the first line treatment typically is going to be to inject steroids into the lesion. So the answer is going to be option A. Don't get me wrong. Can you also do cryotherapy? You can. But honestly, cryotherapy is something that should be you reserve more for second line. First line treatment, although if you look at some studies, I believe some studies show that cryotherapy is super effective, probably a little more effective than steroids. Although many times I think if you combine both, you're actually going to get a better bang for your buck. But in general, you want to inject steroids into the lesions because remember, steroids can inhibit fibroblast activity. So that'll be very helpful in this case. So think of injecting steroids into the lesions as first line, cryotherapy as second line. Don't do option E. Wide excision is not helpful at all because the recurrence rate is almost 100% by trying to cut off a keloid. And then option D, needle aspiration, that's not going to fix the problem. And option C, laser ablation. Laser ablation is not as effective as options A or B. All right. So we're going to go to question 53. Of course, they put an image. So 42-year-old woman is brought to the emergency department by ambulance 20 minutes after a head-on motor vehicle collision in which she was the restrained driver. On arrival, she's alert and reports chest and abdominal pain. Medical history is unremarkable and she takes no medications. Temperature is 36.7 degrees Celsius, that's 98.0 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 120 per minute, so she's tachycardic. Respirations are 28 per minute, she's tachypneic. And blood pressure is 130 over 80. Pulse oximetry on 4 liters per minute of oxygen via nasal cannula shows an oxygen saturation of 90%. She's hypoxic. Breath sounds are decreased on the right. Trachea is in the midline position. Cardiac examination discloses no abnormalities. An abrasion consistent in shape with a seat belt is present over the right upper abdominal quadrant. The area is tender to palpation. Radial and dorsalis pedis pulses are normal bilaterally. Results of lab studies are shown. So EBG, a PO2 is 65 millimeters of mercury. That's low. Her PCO2 is 32 millimeters of mercury. That's low. So she's hyperventilating, which makes sense. So obviously, her pH is 7.38. Makes sense as well. Her hemoglobin is 10.0 gram per deciliter. Her chest x-ray is shown. In addition to intravenous analgesic therapy, which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management, right? So this person is a trauma patient. And we see that this person is short of breath. They're hypoxic. And notice something here. This person has unilaterally decreased breath sound. What does that sound like? I hope you're saying divine. That sounds an awful lot like a pneumothorax. Again, notice I've not even said anything about the image. But if you look at this image, this is a pretty classic image for a pneumothorax. You may notice here that, wow, one side of the lung is white. The other side of the lung is black, right? That black part, right? It tells you there's more, like more x-rays able to go through it, right? That's the part of the lungs that have collapsed, right? Because you've basically taken parenchyma out of the way because the lung has collapsed, right? So this person has a pneumothorax. This person has a pneumothorax of some sort. Well, how do we treat a pneumothorax? We're going to place a chest tube. Of course, the USMLEs many times, they're not going to put chest tube as an answer. They're going to put the surrogate name. So let's look at the answer choices here. Option A says bronchoscopy. No, that's not the way you treat a pneumothorax. Option B says intubation and mechanical ventilation. Nope, don't have to do that. All the time you're wasting doing intubation and mechanical ventilation could fix the patient. Option C says placement of a thoracic epidural. No, we don't do that. Option D says thoracentesis. That's for a pleural effusion. Option E says a thoracotomy. That's like making like a wide incision for the most part in a person's chest. No. Option F says tube thoracostomy. That is absolutely correct. That's another name for chest tube, right? You put that chest tube, it's going to basically let that air out so the lungs can re-expand. So F is correct. Option G says observation only. You're not going, if a person has a small pneumothorax and they're hemodynamically stable, they're not hypoxic, fine. You could do that, but this person doesn't meet those criteria. This person is definitely unstable, definitely hypoxic. You need to place a chest tube. That's the tube thoracostomy. Remember, a needle thoracostomy is the needle decompression. You do that when you're dealing with a tension pneumothorax. A tension pneumothorax, that person will be extremely unstable. And you're going to see like this big time, the trachea will not be in the midline. This person's trachea is pretty midline. So this person does not have a tension pneumothorax. So a tension pneumothorax, you start off with a needle decompression. And then after that, you go to a chest tube. For regular pneumothorax like this one, you're going to just do the chest tube. Another name for needle decompression, as I've said, is needle thoracostomy. Another name for chest tube is tube thoracostomy. The only time where you should pick chest tube or tube thoracostomy as the answer for a tension pneumothorax is if you don't see an answer choice that says needle decompression. All right, so we're going to go to question 54. So, a 31-year-old woman comes to the office because of a 3-month history of intermittent non-bloody diarrhea. The first episode began 5 days after a camping trip in rural Virginia with her family. During the trip, she drank from a spring-fed pond that she says was clean. During the past 3 weeks, she also has had a 5-pound weight loss, that's 2.3 kilograms, despite no change in appetite. She has not had fever or other gastrointestinal symptoms. She has no history of serious illness and takes no medications. She's sexually active with one female partner. The patient is 163 centimeters, that's 5'4" tall, and weighs 54 kilograms, that's 119 pounds. Her BMI is 20 kilograms per meter squared. Temperature is 37.9 degrees Celsius, that's 100.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 85 per minute and regular. Respirations are 12 per minute, and blood pressure is 115 over 70 millimeters of mercury. Abdominal examination shows mild diffuse tenderness to deep palpation. Bowel sounds are increased. Test of the stool for occult blood is negative. Results of a stool smear are shown. Which of the following is the most likely infectious agent? Okay, so option A says Campylobacter jejuni. Option B says Clostridioides difficile. Option C says Entamoeba histolytica. Option D says Escherichia coli. Option E says Giardia lamblia. Option F says Salmonella enteritidis. Option G says Shigella dysenteriae. Okay, so this question, person has diarrhea. Whenever you see a diarrhea question on the USMLEs, the first thing you always want to do is ask yourself, is it bloody or non-bloody? Simple as that. Is it bloody or non-bloody? This is non-bloody. So right off the bat, we can get rid of A. It's not C. jejuni that causes bloody diarrhea. We can get rid of F and G. Those both cause, Salmonella and Shigella both cause bloody diarrhea on the exams. We can also get rid of C, Entamoeba histolytica, that also causes bloody diarrhea. So we're pretty much left with B, D, and E. Okay, B, D, and E, that's pretty manageable. So now we just need to then start looking at what's in the question, right? Option B, C. diff, we're going to see that with recent antibiotic exposure. That we don't see here, so B is gone. Remember, C. diff can cause watery or bloody diarrhea on the USMLEs. Kind of keep that in mind. So now we're stuck between D and E. E. coli and Giardia. Well, if you notice, in this question, this person drank from a pond. That's not smart. So typically, it's a classic situation you see with Giardia. You see a person, they drink from a stream or a pond or whatever. And then they start having this non-bloody diarrhea that kind of lasts for a long time. If you see that, that's going to be Giardia, right? It's going to be Giardia. You shouldn't be drinking from a pond. That doesn't seem like a very smart idea. So we're going to go with option E. E. coli, remember there is E. tec that causes traveler's diarrhea. There is E. hec that causes HUS. So how are we going to treat this person's giardiasis? We're going to treat it with metronidazole. Metronidazole is very effective for treating Giardia. All right. Notice there's this picture here. Of course, if you can recognize the picture, fine. But honestly, I don't really care for it. If you just, again, I think I've said this many times in this series. If you just read your questions carefully, you're usually going to be pretty fine with these image questions. All right. Question 55 says, a randomized placebo-controlled clinical trial is conducted to assess the effectiveness of a selective estrogen receptor modulator, so that's a SERM, so something like a tamoxifen or raloxifen, for chemoprophylaxis of breast cancer. A subset of the results shows. So we see SERM versus placebo, right? You can look at all the data. Which of the following represents the absolute risk reduction for invasive breast cancer per 1,000 woman years in those treated with a SERM? Again, literally, absolute risk reduction is just a difference in risk. This is a pretty easy question. It's a difference in what? In risk. It's a difference in risk. So take one risk and subtract the other. So for example, if you look at this, again, just go to the table and look for what you're asking for. We see that, invasive breast cancer rate per 1,000 woman years in the SERM group is 1. In the placebo group is 3.6. So what's the difference between those numbers? 3.6 minus 1 is 2.6. So the answer is B. So we're done. All right. 56 and 57 are sequential questions. So let's hit those. So let's start with 50. Let's read the question first. So it says a 57-year-old woman comes to the emergency department 1 hour after vomiting bright red blood. She thinks it was approximately 1 cup of blood. Oh, that's a lot. She reports that during the past month, she has felt full sooner than usual while eating. She has not had other episodes of vomiting, and has not had weight loss. She has no history of operative procedures. She has hypertension and type 2 diabetes mellitus. Medications are hydrochlorothiazide and metformin. She has not taken aspirin or NSAIDs during the past month. She does not smoke cigarettes, drink alcohol, or use other substances. Her temperature is 37.0 degrees Celsius. That's 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 116 per minute, so she's tachycardic. Respirations are 16 per minute. And blood pressure is 110 over 78. Examination shows mild tenderness to palpation in the mid-epigastric area. There is no rebound tenderness. Test of the stool for cold blood is positive. Hematocrit is 31%. It's a little bit low. Platelet count is 240,000 per millimeter cubed. That's fine. And prothrombin time is 13 seconds. INR is 1.2. Not too worrisome. Okay, so let's look at this before we even start looking at the questions. So we see this person vomiting bright red blood. And then we're told that, oh, this person during the past month felt full sooner than usual while eating. And we see this mid-epigastric pain. So what does this person have? This person, you know, coughing up blood, and they've had this mid-epigastric pain, probably sounds like an ulcer. Probably sounds like peptic ulcer disease. Sounds a lot like peptic ulcer disease. So one of those ulcers, probably the ulceration has become severe enough that it is ulcerated all the way down to a blood vessel. So the person is puking blood. Okay, so we kind of have some orientation. I'm telling you this, folks. Try to orient yourself before you start jumping into the answers. That's usually just a smart way to take exams, just in general. All right. So question 56 then says, in addition to intravenous administration of fluids and nasogastric tube lavage, which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? All right. So option A says abdominal CT scan. Option B says octreotide scan. Option C says technetium-99m scan. Option D says colonoscopy. Option E says esophagogastroduodenoscopy. That's an EGD. Option F says mesenteric angiography. So this person basically has a GI bleed. How do you manage GI bleeds on the exams? Number one, place two IVs. Literally, place two IVs. Give the person fluids, then give them blood. Right, so give them fluids, give them blood. And then typically you're going to start off with an EGD. You always want to try to roll out upper GI bleeds first. If a person has a GI bleed, roll out upper GI bleeds first. So get an EGD first. If that EGD shows you what you're looking for, fix it with EGD. If that EGD does not show you what you're looking for, your next step is going to be a colonoscopy on your exams. It's going to be a colonoscopy on exams. So this person, well, there's an EGD answer because that has not been done. So they've given fluids and all that stuff. So let's go for EGD. So option E is going to be correct. Let's look at these other answers. Abdominal CT scan is not going to be very helpful when a person has a GI bleed. At least that's not where you start. Octreotide scan is wrong. We use that to identify some neuroendocrine tumors. That's wrong. Technetium-99m scan. That scan, we can use it to identify, what's this pediatric disorder? Come on, Divine, think. It's going to be a young boy, right lower quadrant pain. Meckel's diverticulum. Right. Option D, colonoscopy. That's not an appropriate first step when you've not done an EGD. And then option F says mesenteric angiography. We're going to use that for mesenteric ischemia, right? That's not what's going on here. All right. So question 57 then says, after IV administration of fluids and nasogastric tube lavage, the patient undergoes esophagogastroduodenoscopy. Okay, so we're right. A photograph of the endoscopic findings is shown. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? So this is an example of a question where you absolutely need the image, right? Because they tell you that they've done an EGD, and then they're showing you this, what you see on the EGD. So honestly, without looking at the image for this one, you're not going to get it right. So we can see this person actively bleeding. It's like clear and obvious. But when a person is actively bleeding and you've done your EGD, you see the problem, well, fix it right there. So let's look at the answers. It says option A says octreotide therapy. B says omeprazole therapy. C says tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapy. D says endoscopic hemostatic therapy. E says endoscopic biopsy. F says endoscopic resection. Okay, so let's look at this, right? So again, I said earlier on, literally the past question, that, oh, wait, if a person has a GI bleed, an endoscopy shows you what's going on, just try to fix the problem right there. So we see an active bleed going on. We need to intervene right there. So what's the answer that makes sense? It's going to be option D. Option A and B, believe it or not, are things you're going to do in a GI bleed. But if you can fix the problem immediately, like, because those drugs is going to take a while for them to kick in, right? So go ahead and fix the problem, like stop the bleed with, like, you know, you can burn the vessel or, you know, tie up the vessel or something like that. So option D is going to make the most sense before you do options A, and B. Option C, tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapy. It's kind of a non-specific answer, but that's like what you're doing a person that has, for example, CML, imatinib, right? Imatinib, dasatinib, those are tyrosine kinase inhibitors. You're going to be doing a biopsy when a person is actively bleeding, right? Fix the emergent problem. That's like a testing principle right there. Like if there's an emergent problem staring you in the face, fix that problem. Endoscopic resection, that doesn't really make any sense. Again, now you're seeing active bleeding. And again, if you like the way I explain things, the way I make integrations, just a quick segue here. I think you'll really love the review classes I have. I mean, the month of April, I have a bunch of classes. I have a test taking class. I have classes for step one to step three. I have a 2.5 hour test taking class, a 4-hour biostats class, and a 5-hour social sciences, quality improvement, ethics, and healthcare systems class. Again, many people have taken these classes, found them to be helpful. And then for step two and step three, I have a 20-hour step two, step three review. And I have a last-minute USMLE primer. That's going to be taking place in the month of April. The last-minute primer is a 3-hour class. I'm going to make a separate podcast talking about what that class involves, but I also have a podcast talking about what the classes in April involve. Again, these classes are not lectures. They're over Zoom. They're all based on clinical scenarios, and then I have a bunch of useful charts and tables that can really drive some points home. But in these classes, I try to use exam-style questions to help you understand pathophase, see how the material will be presented, and also help you make integrations across disciplines. Okay, let's jump to question 58. It says, a 77-year-old woman who resides in a skilled nursing care facility is examined by the physician one day after staff noticed some blood on her bed sheets. She sustained a cerebral infarction 8 years ago and has been confined to bed since then because of residual left hemiparesis. She's currently taking warfarin. She's 160 centimeters, that's 5'3 inches tall, and weighs 50 kilograms, that's 110 pounds. A BMI is 20 kilograms per meter squared. Temperature is 36.0 degrees Celsius, that's 96.8 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 70 per minute, respirations are 18 per minute, and blood pressure is 180 over 90. That's pretty high. There is no lymphadenopathy. Examination shows a small clean decubitus ulcer on the sacrum. Makes sense. Pelvic examination shows a 3-centimeter raised fleshy lesion on the right labial majus. Vaginal examination cannot be performed because of the patient's discomfort. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? Okay. So option A says cytologic evaluation of the vulva. Option B says CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis. Come on. Option C says application of an antifungal cream. Option D says application of a corticosteroid cream. Option E says colonoscopy. Option F says biopsy of the vulva. So here's the thing. The thing is, this person obviously has this vulva lesion. He also has a decubitus ulcer. And it's small and clean. So chances are, by saying that, they are telling you that, guys, we've taken care of this decubitus ulcer. All right? So focus on the vulva lesion. The thing is, in an older lady, whenever you see a vulva lesion, you always want to get a biopsy. That's the truth. Because you may be worried, because there are certain concerns here. Is this lichen sclerosis? Although this is probably not lichen sclerosis, given that it's like a raised fleshy lesion. It could also be cancer. So you got to get a biopsy. So I'm going to go with option F here. Option E doesn't make any sense, colonoscopy, right? We don't have any colon cancer concerns. Option D says application of a corticosteroid cream. That's what you do if you're suspected lichen sclerosis. But again, you still got to do the biopsy first, right? If you're putting steroid creams and it's cancer, well, that person is probably not going to do well, right? Option C says application of an antifungal cream. There's no indication for that right now. Option B says CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis. That's not going to help you with a lesion that you can literally see with your eyes. Option A says cytologic evaluation of the vulva. How are you going to do a cytologic evaluation when you've not done a biopsy? It's kind of ridiculous, right? So the answer here is going to be F. All right, let's go to question 59. So a 68-year-old man comes to the office because of a 3-month history of moderate low back pain that extends into both legs. He first noticed the pain while standing in the ticket line at a theater. At that time, the pain was accompanied by tingling in both legs. The symptoms recurred a few days later as he was standing in the grocery checkout line. The pain has not responded to ibuprofen or naproxen. Those are both NSAIDs, but improves with sitting or lying down. Okay, that's helpful. Prior to onset of the pain, the patient typically walked for 30 minutes four times weekly. He discontinued his walking regimen 2 months ago because it seemed to trigger his back pain. He has hypertension and hyperlipidemia. Medications are hydrochlorothiazide, triamterene, simvastatin, and aspirin. The patient has smoked one pack of cigarettes daily for 40 years. Pulse is 74 per minute and blood pressure is 140 over 90 millimeters of mercury. Lungs are clear to auscultation. Expiration phase is delayed, so he's probably got COPD. On cardiac examination, a grade 2 out of 6. Systolic, crescendo decrescendo murmur, is heard at the upper right sternal border. Probably aortic stenosis, makes sense, an old guy. There's trace, and it's got hypertension and all those things. Okay, there's trace ankle edema bilaterally. Ankle brachial index is 1.0. Musculoskeletal and neurologic examinations show no abnormalities. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? So, option A says abdominal aortic aneurysm. Option B says osteoporosis. Option C says peripheral neuropathy. Option D says spinal stenosis. Option E says vascular claudication. So, let's look at this real quick. So, this is a guy. You notice that he has this low back pain. Kind of radiating, extends into both legs. And you're noticing that what are the things that seem to trigger the pain? Well, you notice that this person, whenever he extends his spine, right, he stands up straight, it hurts. But when he sits down, he seems to feel better. Let's see. Where does he say? He says, recurred while standing, right? So that's what triggers the pain. But he says that, man, if he sits down or lies down, the pain gets better, right? So whenever you get in a situation where you almost like curve your spine, the pain seems to improve. But when you kind of stretch out your spine, you're standing straight, it hurts. That's a pretty classic picture for a neurogenic claudication, right? That's lumbar spinal stenosis. So the answer is going to be D. But let's look at the other answers here and kind of cross off a few things, right? So option A says abdominal aortic aneurysm. Can this cause back pain? Yeah. But the thing is, the back pain is not usually going to be positional, right? And many times you'll feel a pulsatile mass. So that's wrong. Option B says osteoporosis. Again, to make a diagnosis of osteoporosis, you either need context. Say, for example, a person that is low weight, like an anorexic patient, for example, or they give you like DEXA scan results where you see a T-score less than negative 2.5. We don't see that here, so that's wrong. Option C says peripheral neuropathy. Again, you won't be having this back problems. You only have like problems in that nerve group, so that's wrong, right? That's wrong. So the answer is D. Option E says vascular claudication. That's a peripheral artery disease. But this guy's ankle brachial index is 1.0. Remember, for you to say a person has PED, their ABI has to be less than 0.9, right? So that's wrong. That's not what's going on here. All right. Now, question 60 says, a 50-year-old man comes to the office because of a 3-day history of mild headache and intermittent confusion. He has a 30-year history of schizophrenia and a 5-year history of emphysema. Medications are clozapine, sertraline, and inhaled beclomethasone and salmeterol. And real quick, let me just comment on spinal stenosis, right? I would just encourage you to keep this in mind that it's more of a myelopathy. It's a spinal cord problem. It's a spinal cord problem. Because basically, your vertebral discs kind of get smaller. And then you basically start squishing on the spinal cord. And it's just much easier to squish the spinal cord when you're in when your spine is an extended position, where you're like standing up straight. But that's why those people's symptoms really hurt, because it's like the compression is even worse during those times. But for these people, if they curve their spine, they flex their spine, then that kind of opens up the spinal canal, reduces the compression on the spinal cord, makes them feel a little better. And typically you're going to manage this with NSAIDs and like physical therapy. If that doesn't work, then you need to do a spinal cord decompression. All right, you need to do a decompressive surgery. All right, so let's go to question 60. That'll be our last question. So a 50-year-old man comes to the office because of a 3-day history of mild headache and intermittent confusion. He has a 30-year history of schizophrenia and a 5-year history of emphysema. Medications are clozapine, sertraline, and inhaled beclomethasone and salmeterol. He also receives home oxygen therapy. He smoked 2 packs of cigarettes daily for 33 years, but quit 5 years ago. Temperature is 36.8 degrees Celsius. That's 98.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Respirations are 20 per minute. Pulse is 90 per minute. And blood pressure is 115 over 70 millimeters of mercury. Examination shows moist mucous membranes. Lungs are clear to auscultation. There's no peripheral edema. Neurologic examination shows no focal findings. Results of a complete blood count are within the reference ranges. Results of other lab studies are shown. So his serum sodium is 116 milliequivalents per liter. That's pretty low. His potassium is 4. That's fine. Chloride is 90. Kind of seems a little bit low there. Urine, nitrogen, creatinine are fine. Glucose is 100. That's fine. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? So this person has hyponatremia. Option A says CT scan of the chest. B says measurement of serum, cortisol, and TSH concentrations. C says measurement of serum uric acid concentrations. D says measurement of urine and plasma osmolarity. And then E says MRI of the brain. So I know some of you may be like, wow, Divine, I don't see an answer that says a hypertonic saline. I mean, this person's sodium is 116. Again, you answer USMLE questions on context. That's why on these exams, you actually have to critically think. You cannot just say, oh, if I ever see hyponatremia, where the person's sodium is like under 120 or something crazy, I'm going to 3% saline. No, use your context, right? Like, obviously, if the person is seizing, then the USMLEs will not give these kinds of answers that are all like diagnostic tests. Instead, they want you to just treat because the person is actively dying. But here, this person, yeah, is not doing well, headache, intermittent confusion, but it doesn't look like they're dying like anytime soon. So we can afford to do some diagnostic testing, right? So again, just use critical thinking on these exams. So option E says CT scan of the chest. You're probably putting that to make you think of lung cancer, small cell lung cancer, SIDH. But again, this person just doesn't have many antecedents of lung cancer, other than the fact that he has a 66-pack year smoking history. This person has not lost weight. They've not been having cough or anything like that. That's wrong. Option B says measurement of serum cortisol and TSH concentration. These labs don't seem to show us that this person has a cortisol or TSH problem. The person doesn't seem to have signs of hyper or hypothyroidism. That's wrong. Option C says measurement of serum uric acid concentrations. Nah, that's wrong. That's wrong. They will be doing that if we're worried about gout. No. Although, like, typically, answer choices on the USMLEs that say measure the serum uric acid concentration, usually not a good idea on the exams. It's almost like consulting the ethics committee in a sense. It's rarely ever correct. Option D says measurement of urine and plasma osmolarity. Yeah, I would say that that makes a lot of sense. Right, we want to figure out what's causing this person's hyponatremia. So we want to check the serum and the urine. And then option E says MRI of the brain. That's ridiculous. No, that's not what's going on here. Again, so option D makes sense. I'll just give my thoughts on what I think this person has. This person probably has SIDH. And the one big thing that kind of tells me that you have SIDH is the fact that he's taking sertraline. SSRIs are a pretty common cause of SIDH, believe it or not. So, because if you have SIDH, you're going to be sucking up all this free water from your urine. So your serum is going to be dilute, but urine is going to be very concentrated. So that can cause this hyponatremia. All right, so I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, I offer review sessions for Step 1 all the way to Step 3, Complex 1 to 3. I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I have a YouTube channel where I post the videos that I make. I also help with ERAS applications and personal statements and all those things for residency. I also tutor for med school exams. And I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week, from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson through two podcasts. Usually I post them on Fridays and Sundays, schedule permitting. But many people have listened to those podcasts and found them to be very helpful. They're usually about 10 minutes long. I'm pretty sure we have almost 260 episodes right now. So there's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.